Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and I'm joined today by my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak. John Wells, out on assignment somewhere in the further reaches of where there's science and technology. Today, we speak first with Sarah Scholes, all about her article, Is This ET? It's the mystery of strange radio bursts from space. Yes, is it, I don't know, extraterrestrials, some inexplicable interference from space? Certainly, these radio blasts were picked up. Sarah and some colleagues published a paper on these strange radio bursts about a month ago. The story was all over the media, and stay tuned for what happened next.
That's right, Lynn. Good morning. And then we speak with Xavier Siemens. He's the chair of Nanograv Physics Frontier Center, and he's also the associate professor at the Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. He'll talk to us about a new grant they received from the National Science Foundation to study, among other things, gravitational waves.
Yes, it's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak. Hey, we also have a couple of great cool science stories in the news.
Right.
One of those they were just talking about on NPR, and that is the eruption of the Calbuco volcano in Chile.
Right.
Yes, we'll talk about that. Also a cure for Ebola, and what else?
Oh, we have a little piece about March, this past March, being the warmest March globally ever recorded. It's a news item we didn't get a chance to cover on This Green Earth. And another one was that we didn't get a chance was about quagga mussels showing up in Deer Creek Reservoir, what they are and what they mean to the reservoir, the potential impacts of their appearance.
Okay.
Why it's not good.
We'll get to all of that. Well, our first guest is Sarah Scholes. She'll talk to us about her article, Is This ET? Mysteries of Strange Radio Bursts from Space. It's an interesting look both at the article and how science is reported. Scholes and her colleagues published the article about these strange radio bursts in March, and the media picked it up, and then, well, Sarah joins us now by phone to give us the rest of this story. Sarah Scholes, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're glad you could join us. We talked about these radio bursts actually with a scientist at University of Utah a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it was a big mystery. But first, talk about what was the catalyst for the article and what was the story?
Yes. So these radio bursts are a mystery. They just last a few milliseconds, which is obviously not very long. It's kind of between the amount of time it takes for a honeybee or a housefly to flap its wings. But in that amount of time, they can release huge amounts of energy, like occasionally the amount that the sun releases in a month, and they just flash on, flash off, and disappear, and nobody really knows what causes them or where they come from. And so these scientists named Michael Hipke and John Learned wanted to see if there were any mathematical patterns in these radio bursts. And they themselves are not actually fast radio burst astronomers. Michael is a data scientist, and John Learned kind of works all over the map in astronomy. So they just looked into the information that was available on these, and they found a strange pattern, or what seemed to be a strange pattern, in something called dispersion measure. So when these bursts travel through space, they encounter just sitting out there between the stars. And these electrons slow some radio waves down more than others. The radio waves have a range of frequencies, like if you think of the FM band of the radio, they could be spread across that, like that range, but they're different frequencies. So with these bursts, if you tried to broadcast the whole FM band at once, for instance, the higher frequencies, like 107.7, would arrive before the lower frequencies, like 87.7. And so that is a measure of how far something has gone in space or how many electrons it has encountered, which is all backstory to say that they discovered that all of these radio bursts have dispersion measures, or a measure of how spread out those signals are, that were all multiples of this one number, 187.5. One of them was 2 times 187.5, a few were 3 times 187.5, and then all the way up to, I believe, 5 times 187.5.
I have to stop you there because I'm already a little confused.
Okay, sorry.
So these bursts, these fast radio bursts,
mm-hmm.
when were they first discovered or picked up?
So they were first discovered in 2007 by a scientist named Duncan Lorimer.
And how did he discover them?
He was looking for these objects called pulsars, which are the kind of dead remnants, leftovers of really massive stars that have exploded, and then they leave this really dense core that spins around really fast and sends a burst of light, of radio light, in Earth's direction once every time they spin. And so he was looking for these, which kind of go, you know, blip, 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 and send a burst once every few milliseconds sometimes. And so while he was looking for these, instead of seeing something that repeated like that, like a pulsar, he saw just one really large burst.
Ah. And you said this burst had the energy of equal to that energy which is emitted by the sun in an entire month.
Yeah, it appeared that way, which is right. That's a crazy amount of energy and a big mystery. So after he discovered it, no one saw any more for a long time.
Huh.
Does that mean they ceased to exist?
Well, we ceased to find them, at least, until actually 2014. They found a few more.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is just due to, you know, it's one burst coming from one spot in the sky, and so you have to be looking at that spot when it's happening, and we don't have telescopes pointed everywhere all
right.
the time.
Right.
So between early 2014 and now, we've found 10 more. So now we have a total of 11 bursts.
Okay, so 11 events.
11 events.
Events
yeah.
that have been detected.
Not a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're looking for these, I assume, all the time. There is a means of looking for them all the time.
Actually, they're not looking for them all the time because astronomers have to share these telescopes.
Right.
So each project gets a certain amount of time. So there are surveys going on that look for them a lot of the time, but no one is monitoring constantly, at least as far as I know.
And when did the mathematical dispersion, the 187.5, when was that discovered? Was that recent?
That was just discovered in this paper that my article was about. So in mid-March, they saw this. So no one had noticed this pattern before.
Okay. And what did this this constant, this consistent dispersion equation suggest to you and other scientists?
Well, as the authors of the paper were very careful to say, it's most likely a natural explanation. Like, there's probably, if this pattern exists, and it could be a coincidence, because as we just pointed out, 11 isn't a whole lot, and you can kind of find patterns in small numbers where maybe they wouldn't be there if mm-hmm. we had more bursts. So there's that possibility. But mm-hmm. then there's also the possibility that the pattern does exist, and something is happening naturally that we don't understand.
Because there are lots of patterns, mathematical patterns, in nature.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we see patterns appear, and Although we don't understand where this one comes from, if it is in fact real, that doesn't mean it doesn't have a natural explanation that we haven't discovered yet.
Okay.
And at least the last time I talked to the scientists, they didn't know what that explanation might be, but that is possible. The other possibilities are that we're picking up ourselves. We're picking up evidence of our own technology, maybe a satellite.
Satellite, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is emitting a signal that looks like it's from far away. So in that case, they would be spreading out this signal, dispersing it on purpose, and then it would just look like it came from very far away, but it would just be, you know, a spy satellite or something we didn't know was up above our planet. And then the last possibility is that it is evidence of someone else's technology, not human technology, but alien technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is what the article was about, was, you know, what could the natural explanations for this be? Do we have a satellite that most of us don't know about? Or what happens if we have accidentally discovered that some kind of extraterrestrial civilization has embedded this pattern in these crazy signals that we're seeing?
Right.
Okay.
So everything's in play right now, basically.
Right.
All the theories are in play. I want to go back to you said there's been 11 of these bursts detected.
Mm-hmm.
Has there any sense, like you say, it's difficult to figure out exactly where, you know, what neighborhood they're coming from. Has there been any pattern there as far as its potential location in the galaxy?
People have looked at that to see if they are coming from kind of the middle of the galaxy, like the equator of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there is not, that they seem to come from all over the sky.
Okay.
And not. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this your article was published March 31st of this year, just last month,
mm-hmm.
In New Science. And you probably were surprised, or maybe you weren't, to find how the media picked this up, because, of course, you know, you hear there might be life out there, intelligent life out there.
Right.
So talk about that, how it got spread throughout the media.
I actually was surprised, and I'm relatively new to science journalism, so this was the first time that this had happened to me. But I guess when you put ET in the headline of something, that gets noticed. And so what kind of happens is that people notice it, readers get excited about it, and then other outlets start to write about it again. And then sometimes what happens is that all the caveats get stripped out of it, like the perhaps there's a natural explanation, perhaps it's satellites. The headline then becomes, we found aliens. And so that was interesting to experience. And then after that, after a rash of articles comes out about how maybe we found aliens, mm-hmm. then come the counter articles about how we definitely haven't found aliens. And that actually brought about an interesting conversation with the scientists who do study these radio bursts all the time, who actually have a new set of radio bursts that they have not released out into the public yet. And they say that these don't match this pattern, that they prove this pattern wrong, but we don't actually have that data to look at.
So this new set of radio bursts, they don't follow the mathematical pattern, but are they similar in some way, or are they completely different, a completely different set?
They seem to be the same phenomenon.
Whatever
it is, they seem to be coming from the same mysterious kinds of objects.
Well, this is interesting then, because does this go to the ideas of scientific collaboration and building consensus, where some scientists are collecting data and other scientists may be reticent about releasing data or information until they can have, you know, an even better paper that they could produce? Is there a bit of that gamesmanship that goes on in this?
I think that has gone on, especially since the authors of the paper about the pattern don't typically study these fast radio bursts. They
right.
told me that they talked to the people who do study these and asked if they had new data and new bursts that they could share. And those fast radio burst scientists said, well, it's not released yet. We have some, but we can't give it to you because we haven't published this paper.
Right.
So if they had collaborated, maybe this paper about the pattern would never have come out. On the other hand, none of us have seen this paper yet. It's still not out with the new birth. So we kind of just have to take their word for it, which is kind of the opposite of science. Like, the authors of the pattern paper want to do the test and check it themselves, you know, saying, trust me, your pattern is wrong is not, that doesn't necessarily go well for scientists.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So as a new science journalist, did you find yourself wanting to, you know, call up People magazine or whatever it was and say, well, wait a minute, I didn't say that, nor did the science?
Yes, I did. I really wanted to point out all of the, I tried to be actually very careful in my article to say, like, this is kind of a what if speculation, this is an interesting discussion to have, and I think it's worth talking about, and I wish you had included all of my nuance in your article, but yeah. I kind of just had to sit back and watch it happen. And, I mean, actually, by the time an article, you know, a science article gets on CNN or Huffington Post or something, it's so far removed from the original article that probably most people don't know that the first article came from New Scientist.
Yes.
Maybe I'm clear.
That's true. It's probably watered down or condensed to a typical bumper sticker base message that doesn't even begin to catch the nuances of the real information behind the story.
So, Sarah, since then you found some interesting discoveries about the science. Talk about that.
Yeah. So there's a group of bursts that look a lot like fast radio bursts, and they appear to be coming from Earth. They're called peritons, P-E-R-Y-T-O-N-S. And these were first discovered in 2011. And people took them as evidence that fast radio bursts weren't real, that they also came from Earth, like these peritons, which they appear as bursts and last a few milliseconds and then disappear, but they don't come from one specific spot in the sky. People were wondering, you know, if these are not from space and they're not fast radio bursts, what are they? And soon after this paper, some scientists at the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia found out that these bursts actually come from people opening microwaves before their food or their coffee is done cooking. So
that's scary.
What?
Yeah, I know. So if you put your coffee in the microwave, you do it for a minute and 30 seconds, and then you realize it's going to be too hot, so you open the door before the timer goes off.
Without stopping at first.
Right.
Yeah, right, without stopping at first. You open the door, and the thing inside the microwave that is emitting these waves, which is called, a magnetron, isn't finished releasing waves, and so the second you open the door, it hasn't quite finished, and so there's a burst that makes it out of the microwave, and these scientists in Australia discovered that was where these things that looked a lot like fast radio bursts were coming from astronomers reheating their coffee.
Okay, this is both fascinating, kind of hilarious, but a little bit scary.
A little disconcerting.
At the same time, and so the message to our listeners is stop the microwave. And you know, over the years, ever since microwaves came on into existence, which I think was when I was a little kid, so you know, in the mid-60s, there have been discussions back and forth about what it does to your food and how it ruins it and don't stand near it. But this, showing that these waves that are emitting as much energy as the sun's light.
What?
What do you think about that, Sarah? What does it tell us about microwaves?
Well, so the strength of them as being as strong as the sun emits in 1 month is actually just if we assume that they're coming very far away, they had to start out that strong. So if it's
right.
coming from
yeah.
our microwave, it doesn't actually have to be that strong.
There you go.
But still, nobody likes to think they're being bombarded by microwaves. But As far as I know, there's no evidence that these waves can hurt you. And the other good news is the reassurance from the scientists who did this experiment is that it lasts so little time and is mostly, you know, it's mostly caught. Like the telescope can pick it up, but your body is not going to pick it up in quite the same way. So I don't think, I mean, it's probably still a good idea to stop the microwave, but I don't think that any of us is in grave danger.
Okay. Last question then is, when do you anticipate another paper or more information about this phenomena coming out?
I think that the burst paper with the new burst, so that we can see if they do or do not match this pattern, they're planning to have it come out this summer.
Summer, okay.
Fast radio bursts. FRBs is what they call them, so our listeners can watch out for articles. And Sarah, I'm just wondering, are you a freelance science journalist, or do you always write for New Science?
No, I'm freelance. I write for whoever will take me.
Okay.
That's the way to go.
That pays the bills. Will you continue on this topic?
Definitely. I'm definitely planning to keep an eye on the new developments.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, Sarah Scholes, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a really interesting story and very interesting on the way science is reported.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
All right.
Sarah Scholes, she is a science journalist. Her article in New Science.
Yeah, it's just fascinating that this is a piece of science that's in play. Like I say, it's no one has quite figured it out, and it can be any number of origins.
That's right.
Sources, and that's what's really interesting when you're working in science.
And that the different sets of the fast radio bursts that are alike in different ways, one with the mathematical pattern, the 187.5,
right,
have not all been connected back to microwaves.
No.
But so it remains to be
seen. There's not enough data.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. You just don't have enough data yet to figure out exactly what's going on. All right. To be continued.
To be continued. And stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment after these messages.
Mom. Hey, Mom. My birthday's coming up, and I know exactly what I want to do. Bounce houses, floor hockey, video games. I want to go to the PC Mech.
I hear they're having a sale. Buy any party package and get a free second hour in the party room or free half gym rental for an hour.
Climbing wall, basketball, pizza, and cake. I want to go to the PC Mech.
I'll call to book it between March 1st and May 31st while the sale's going on.
ParkCityRecreation.org. The number is 615-5401.
PC Mark, a KPCW supporter and nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We were just speaking with Sarah Scholes, science journalist, and very interesting about fast radio bursts.
That's right. And now we're going to move on to some other secrets or so of the universe. Have you ever pondered things like gravitational waves, black holes, and the collision of neutron stars? Maybe not. Perhaps your understanding of these things is limited, but when more science and research are conducted to find out, it brings those things that lurk and explode in the cosmos about us closer to us. And that's what our next guest is doing with his work. A new project will be directed by Javier Siemens, a physicist at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. It's a search for more knowledge about gravitational waves, those elusive ripples in the fabric of space-time predicted to arise from extremely energetic and large-scale cosmic events, such as the collisions of neutron stars and black holes. This research is all part of a $14.5 million five-year award from the National Science Foundation that Javier is going to head up, and he joins us by phone to talk more about this research. Javier, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure.
Hey, let's start just with some background. You know, I know only enough about gravitational waves from what I just read from the press release. Talk about the basic concept of a gravitational wave.
So the basic concept is really an analogy with electromagnetic waves. So electromagnetic waves are produced by moving charges like electrons and protons. Mm-hmm. And so mass is the charge of gravity. And so moving, accelerating massive objects are expected to produce gravitational waves.
Okay. And so if I understand this right, these waves are, you know, very difficult to detect because they last tens of nanoseconds over a period of years. They are huge waves. These are the, are they safe to say, the largest waves, wavelength in the universe?
Actually, they're not. There's even longer wavelength gravitational waves that come from the very, very early universe, and they're formed in the period of a very rapid acceleration called inflation. So that leaves, and you might have heard about the BICEP 2 experiment from about a year ago now, a little over a year ago. So those gravitational waves are even longer wavelengths than the ones that we're sensitive to.
Okay. Now, the gravitational waves are produced by black holes interacting with each other?
That's right. So in the most promising sources of gravitational waves for our experiment are produced by supermassive black holes that live at the centers of galaxies. And so galaxies, the size and composition of galaxies as we see them today is thought to arise from a hierarchical process where small galaxies early on merge to form medium-sized galaxies, and those merge again, and so on, to form the large galaxies that we see today. Now, because galaxies host supermassive black holes at their centers, each time one of these mergers occur, we're going to have the black holes at the centers of these galaxies eventually meet, orbit each other, radiate gravitational waves, and merge.
Okay, so when were these waves first detected instrumentally?
So they've never been directly detected instrumentally. That's part of the excitement of the experiment.
Okay.
We have very strong indirect evidence from a system known as the Hulse-Taylor binary. This is a binary neutron star pair that was observed for many, many years, and the orbital decay that was measured was consistent with the emission of gravitational radiation.
So
that's the evidence that we had, and Hulse and Taylor actually got a Nobel Prize for that in 1993.
Oh.
But we have never actually directly detected them.
Okay. So that's part of it. Like you say, that's the hope of this research.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Well, and how do you propose to come up with something that can detect one?
So there's several ideas out there for how to detect gravitational waves, and I can tell you about our experiment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We use these kinds of stars called pulsars. Mm-hmm. And pulsars are a type of neutron star which we observe with radio telescopes, and they rotate extraordinarily stably. These neutron stars, or these pulsars, have beams of radio waves that are coming out of their magnetic poles, and they rotate very stably, as I mentioned. And if the beam of radio waves coming out of the pole intersects with a line of sight between the Earth and the pulsar, then we observe these stars as point sources that emit bursts of radio waves. And because they rotate very stably, we can use them as clocks, basically as cosmic clocks.
Mm-hmm.
And as a gravitational wave is passing through the Earth pulsar system, it will change the light travel time of these bursts, and that's the effect that we're hoping to detect.
Very interesting.
Wait, we just got done talking about pulsars with our first guest as a potential source. I don't know if you heard that.
I actually know Sarah's pulse.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're familiar with that? What's going on there? Is there a relationship between those potentially?
No. I mean, a lot of the folks that I work with in the radio astronomy community are involved in this in these fast radio bursts.
Mm.
So that's how I know this area.
Okay.
Okay. So say you find out a way to detect these gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
You then move into the process of seeing how the waves are creating this merging of these black holes in varying galaxies to create this one supermassive black hole, the merging of black holes. What will that, what does that tell us? I mean, what does it mean? What are the implications of merging black holes?
That's a great question. What it's going to tell us is about whether our ideas of structure formation, how galaxies grow to form the from very early irregular clumps to the spiral galaxies and elliptical galaxies that we see today nearby, how that structure formation process works. Basically, that's what is going to inform us about. Mm-hmm. More generally, the difference between, say, our experiment or other experiments that are out there for gravitational wave detection and the Hulse-Taylor binary that I referred to earlier, is that what we're trying to do is really make a telescope, a gravitational wave telescope, which is analogous to, electromagnetic telescopes like optical telescopes or radio telescopes or X-ray telescopes, et cetera, that will allow us to create an image of the universe using gravitational waves. And this is completely different from the Hulse-Taylor binary, and that's the sort of distinction that I was trying to make between direct and indirect. The Hulse-Taylor binary, gives us very good indirect evidence for gravitational waves, but you can't use it to make a picture of the universe at all. It just tells us about that particular system. But what we're trying to do is really to paint a picture of the universe using gravitational waves.
Okay. And one of the telescopes, if I understand it correctly, is in Puerto Rico.
That's correct, yep, at the Arecibo Observatory.
Okay, and so I guess, again, we spoke with our first guest, you'd love to have this telescope at your use day in and day out, but you have to share these telescopes with other researchers. So you only have a limited amount of time. So how much time do you have to spend on this research?
So right now... a few months ago we got our proposals approved again, and I think right now we're using about 700 hours a year.
Wow.
Of telescope time. We're actually really quite fortunate. Our proposals are typically very high ranked, and so we get the time that we need to do our observations.
Okay.
So there's
another telescope that we use. We actually use the two best radio telescopes in the world. So Arecibo is the largest radio telescope in the world, so it has a lot of area, so it's very sensitive. We also use the Greenback Telescope in West Virginia, which is the second largest radio telescope in the world, and it's the largest steerable radio telescope. So both of those we have access basically to the best telescopes in the world.
Right.
So we're able to deliver the best science.
Okay.
And was it through these telescopes, these two telescopes, that the fast radio bursts were detected as well, that Sarah Scholes was talking about?
So I believe the first FRB was actually detected at using the Parkes radio telescope in Australia.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That's right.
She was talking about...
That
was
the latest
for the
one. That was mm-hmm. Okay. Going back to... I wanted to go back to the theoretical. You haven't detected this, instrumentally, but when was gravitational waves first predicted, say, theoretically?
1918, actually, by Einstein.
Einstein.
So shortly after he published his theory of gravity called general relativity in 1915, mm-hmm. A few years after that, he published a paper predicting the existence of gravitational waves.
No wonder it's so exciting,
yeah.
proving Einstein's theory.
Right. And in addition to that, we have a chance to actually test Einstein's theory of gravity in a completely new way. So if Einstein's theory of gravity is not right, then we may expect to see a different effect of gravitational waves on the pulsar Earth system. And that's one of the things that we're looking for. In fact, your audience may be interested to know that one of our graduate students is from Utah.
Right.
She got her undergrad at Utah State, and she's been working with me a couple of years ago. She actually just defended her thesis on Monday successfully, and she was working with me on this particular problem. So using gravitational waves that we can detect with pulsars to test Einstein's theory of gravity.
Explain that a little bit more, if you would, and maybe, less physics terms and more layperson's terms. Testing Einstein's theory of gravity. How are you doing it?
Well, so the simplest way I can explain it, I think, is as follows. Einstein's theory of gravity tells us that the pulsar Earth system will respond in a particular way. And what I mean by respond is will move in a particular way when a gravitational wave passes. But other theories say that it will move in different ways. The system will move in different ways. Remember, what the gravitational wave is doing is changing the light travel time, effectively shrinking and stretching the distance between the pulsar and the Earth in a particular way, which depends on where the gravitational wave is coming from, among other things. But if Einstein's theory of gravity is not right, then we would expect a gravitational wave from, say, that same direction to make the pulsar Earth system move in a different way. And that's sort of the easy way of explaining how we perform these tests.
So I'll go there. If Einstein's theory is proved to be incorrect, what are the consequences? Is there a ripple effect associated with that? Is everything else coming to question?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, let me say that I think that while it's very important to perform all these tests, my feeling is that we will find that, you know, we won't be able to show that Einstein's theory is not correct.
Right.
But that's my intuition about this.
Sure.
But of course, but it's really important to do these tests, because if we do find it that Einstein's theory is incorrect, then that has really profound consequences.
Yeah.
There are right now two outstanding problems in fundamental physics. One of them is the unifying quantum mechanics with gravity, with Einstein's theory of general relativity. And the other one is the origin of cosmic acceleration in the universe. So we know that the universe is accelerating, so-called late-time acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
And an alternative theory of gravity, a theory of gravity which is different from Einstein's, could shed light on either or both of these things. And so that's very profound. And so that's why we do these tests.
Okay.
Wow. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Javier Siemens. He's an associate professor at the Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics in the Department of Physics at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And talk a little bit, if you would, about the Nanograv Physics Frontiers Center. That's also, is that part of the university that you're associated with?
My group here at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is part of that collaboration. So Nanograv is a U.S. and Canadian collaboration of about 60 students and scientists and postdocs at about 15 institutions. And it was formed originally in 2007 and with a much smaller group of people, and it's about 20 people or so. And since then, the group has basically tripled in size. With many more students and many more scientists involved. And the Nanograv Physics Frontier Center is one of 10 physics frontier centers. So the NSF funds 10 of these centers across the country. And we are one of those centers. So we now have operational funds for the next 5 years to carry on our experiment.
Okay. And if this is, like, say, a U.S.-Canadian collaboration, are there other researchers in Europe, China, Russia, doing similar work?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Nanograv is one of three so-called pulsar timing arrays, and there's two other pulsar timing arrays. One of them is in Europe. It's called the European Pulsar Timing Array, and it's several European countries that are involved. And primarily, Germany, the UK, France, and Italy. Those are the four main players, I believe, in Europe. And they use a collection of radio telescopes around Europe, spread out around Europe. And also, the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array that uses the Parkes telescope that I mentioned earlier with regards to the FRBs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an Australian group that uses that. That radio telescope called the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, and we have a kind of competitive and cooperative type of relation. So typically, what happens is we collect our data with our radio telescopes, and we publish our papers, and then we come together collectively as the International Pulsar Timing Array, put together all our data sets, and analyze them jointly.
Okay.
And the idea. The rationale for that is that by putting together all our data, we'll have a more sensitive data set and we'll be able to detect gravitational waves more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So our expectation is that the first detection of these very low frequency, long wavelength gravitational waves will come from these international pulsar timing array data sets, the merged data sets.
Okay. Mm.
The more you talk, Javier, the more it makes me think that the National Science Foundation ought to be giving you more than $14.5 million. But I can see how you get time on those telescopes, and it's big science.
That's right, and that time costs money too. So that's
Well, I was curious about the telescopes themselves, the one in Arecibo and I think it was Green Bank. Is that in West Virginia?
That's in West Virginia, right. That's right.
Are they open to the public?
Yes, they both are open to the public.
Really?
And they both have a visitor center that you can go to.
Oh.
We just had our latest collaboration meeting was in February. We held it in Arecibo. So we actually visit the sites fairly frequently. So I'm familiar with them, and yeah, they both have very nice visitor centers, actually.
Oh, I'm kicking. I was in like an hour away from Arecibo this past summer, and I missed my opportunity. Yeah, I don't know, and I would have gone over there.
It is actually spectacular there. It's kind of hard to imagine. It's 300 meters, so that's about the size of three football fields across, and it's a static dish, so it's sort of sitting in kind of like a valley, sort of semi-spherical kind of valley, and the receivers are hung from cables. So there's a 9-ton sort of building basically hanging on top of the telescope where the receivers are housed. It's just really an impressive thing to look at. And similarly with the Green Bank telescope, it's that one is 100 meters, so it's the size of a football field, and it's fully steerable. So they move it around. A whole football field basically can point at most of the sky, can see most of the sky with it.
Wow.
But both instruments are just spectacular, world-class instrumentation that we are very fortunate to have access to.
So it would seem to me in West Virginia, you know, we think of telescopes being in places like the Atacama Desert in Chile, where
mountaintops,
mountaintops where there's no light pollution. But West Virginia doesn't seem to fit that bill. And is it something about a radio telescope in particular that allows that?
Yeah, absolutely. So radio astronomy you can do any time of the day or night. So we don't care whether the sun is out or not, or any issues with light pollution, because it's much longer wavelength than visible light. But I should point out, though, that West Virginia, the site where the Green Bank Telescope is located is actually a radio quiet zone in the U.S. So we do have problems with man-made interference, for example, cell phones and radars and radio stations and so on, that do cause problems for us.
So they have no public radio. How do they survive without NPR?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether they don't have public radio. They definitely are not allowed to have cell phones.
Oh.
And that's at Green Bank, yeah. And also all the cars that they have that work on the site, they don't have they're diesel engines, so they don't have spark plugs, because spark plugs can generate radio interference as well.
Interesting.
And they have a person there who's actually in charge of going around the site and looking for problems looking for sources of radio interference.
Wow. So how far is the radius of this area they don't allow spark plugs and gas-powered engines and cell phones?
I'm not sure. It's several tens of miles,
actually.
Wow. I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not sure. But, yeah, it's a pretty large area.
That's fascinating.
That really is.
That might explain several things about West Virginia, but that
and so no doubt they haven't seen any fast radio bursts from Virginia, because there are no microwaves allowed there either, right?
Well, that's the source of some of the fast radio bursts that were observed, but not all of them.
It's all coming together on Cool Science Radio this morning.
Yeah. Yeah, we have learned so much. Okay, I have a final question. We always like to connect, when we talk to scientists, back to the youth and those, we push so much into STEM education now. And, if you're in Mr. Matthews' AP Physics class at Park City High School, how might you, do your research paper on this topic? It's pretty interesting. What would you sort of guide
good
kids
sources
towards? Yeah.
That's a great question. I would probably start by looking at our website, nanograph.org, and trying to get some of the materials there. We do have a pretty extensive outreach component to the activities that we do. So we actually do have high school students and undergraduates involved in research. And what they do is to actually remotely operate the radio telescopes that we use, so both Arecibo and Green Bank. So you can actually, it turns out you can do this from your laptop.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So we train them in these activities. And the main activities that they do is actually pulsar searching. So right now we are looking at, you know, I mentioned the pulsar Earth system before, but we are really looking at on the order of 50 pulsars right now, 50 different pulsars. And the idea there is that, you know, if you measure a signal from one of the pulsars, you can't really say for sure that it's a gravitational wave. But if you see it in many different pulsars, then you can be more certain that it's not of other astrophysical origin or instrumental origin, for that matter.
So that's nanograv.org.
That's right.
A fantastic opportunity for undergrads and high school kids.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Wow, I'm glad I asked the question.
And
adults, you're going to go home
too.
And do it, too.
Yeah, sure.
I'd like to remotely control the telescope.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. And best of luck to you with your National Science Foundation Award.
Yeah.
$14.5 million. It's a five-year award. And our guest, Professor Javier Siemens, is directing the program. Thanks for joining us, Javier.
Thank you.
All right.
How about that? It's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back with some cool science stories in the news.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my guest co-host, Chris Cherniak, today. We were just speaking with Javier Siemens, and he's associate professor of physics and astronomy.
Astrophysics, and cosmology, et cetera.
On and on and on. Really interesting.
Gravitational waves,
and
yes.
And it turns out there was a tie-in to our first guest about fast radio bursts, Sarah Scholes. She wrote the article in New Science. We want to thank both of our guests today. And we have a couple of cool science stories. You know, starting off with, a lot of people have heard by now that there is, in southern Chile, they've declared a state of emergency as the Calbuco volcano erupts. Now, this volcano has not erupted. Last time was about 43 years ago.
Wow.
And, so far, I think they evacuated about 250 people, and it's a bunch of smoke plumes and
thousands. Actually, now it's
up to thousands.
Several thousands. And actually, this Chile, in general, has 90 active volcanoes. We have lots of active volcanoes around here. But they have 90, and Calbuco is considered one of the most dangerous. So everyone is paying close attention to this one.
And, there's substantial volcanic activity in Chile right now. It's the second volcano in southern Chile to have had a substantial eruption. Mm. Since March 3rd, when the Villarrica volcano, and that's a big tourist area, Villarrica.
Is it?
Yeah. I'm forgetting the name of the town that's near there, but it's a big tourist center, kind of the Lake District. It emitted a brief but very fiery burst of ash and lava. And so this is big volcanic activity. And I think they're learning more about some volcanic activity, not quite ready to be released in the Yellowstone area.
Yes.
Moving off of the Pacific coast and, back here, back into the Wild West. So
yes.
More on that.
A study that's going to be coming out
right,
shortly.
We'll bring that up next week. And moving away from ash and molten lava. And let's move into drought.
Yeah, the drought, the one that's around here, more that resonates more with us.
And affects our daily lives.
A recent article out of 24/7 Wall Street compared last year, the amount of Utah land affected by severe to exceptional drought to this year. All right, so let me get this right. The drought is parching an estimated 53% of Utah compared with 18% of land last year.
That's right.
And from 18% to 53% is now under is considered under exceptional drought in this state.
And that's affecting an estimated 2.1 million people that live in the area that is currently experiencing severe.
That's pretty much all of the state.
Yeah, that's a big portion of our population. I'm not sure what our overall population is, but, you know, as of April 1st, when snowpacks here in Utah usually peak, well, now, I mean, we're almost, our runoff is going to be very lackluster. But this is why Utah made the list of the top 10 states with the biggest amount
where,
of drought. Well, we are number three. And that's not really a surprise. You can
we
imagine.
We can do better.
Yeah.
Can't we?
Yeah, we can beat California.
Aren't we trying to always be American exceptionalism or now Utah? Except we're behind California and Nevada.
Which is no surprise as California has Governor Jerry Brown, you know, recently announced some real severe drought restrictions.
Yes, like you have to ask for water at a restaurant instead of just being handed it to you.
Is that one of them?
There's no restrictions on farmers per se. But at your local restaurant, you now
you
have
can't
to ask
for
water.
8 ounces of water.
Yes. So those are some of the things that were put into place.
Is that right?
It's true.
Mm. Okay.
So we're going to start with us, to start with changing our behaviors as residents, and then they'll work their way up to the biggest water user in the state of California, the farmers.
Which I always find so interesting, even here in Park City, when we're asked to water every other day and our grass turns brown, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile,
the local alfalfa and hay growers are
golf courses, soccer fields. That sort of thing. It's interesting.
Why does that happen?
It should go the opposite way.
Yes. Well, we'll find out if that'll happen. It'll take a little more drought, a few more years of drought for maybe that'll occur. But right now, again, we're 53% of the state of Utah is under exceptional drought conditions compared to just 18% last year. Now we're having snow. You know, like you talked about this earlier this morning, maybe up to a foot of snow at what? Elevations above 10,000 feet?
Nine to 10,000 feet,
okay.
Right. And that's coming up this weekend. So.
Right, and we'll have rain at lower elevations, but it'll do very little to change these percentages.
That's right, because those big snowfalls, even though they're great to get this time of year, they need to come when the snowpack is building.
Yeah.
And that way they stay with the accumulation. It acts as a reservoir. Right now, there is no reservoir concept happening. So we're going to head back into a few underwriting spots, and we'll be back.
Spring is here, and Wasatch and Soldier Hollow Golf Courses in Midway are now open and proud to support KPCW. Youth and annual passes and clinics are available. Go to SoldierHollowGolf.com or WasatchGolfCourse.com for tee times and information.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at HideoutCanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio today. And thanks to Chris Cherniak, my guest co-host.
Sure.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
It was very interesting. We also want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
Peak Art and Frame,
and Nexus IT.
That's right. And it's 44 degrees in Old Town Park City. Beautiful day so far. Should be clouding up later on. We'll hopefully see some rain later on. They've been promising it for a few days now. And overnight, we could see a few snowflakes. But the biggest chance for precipitation, again, coming on Saturday, an 80% chance of snow. And way up high in the mountains, and a good time to go skiing at those resorts that are still open.
Really?
What is it? Snowbird and, yeah, I think Alta on weekends.
Oh.
Because there could be up to a foot of snow, apparently.
Fresh snow. Yay, winter, finally here.
That's right. Stay tuned now for news. You're listening to KPCW Park City.